I say, waiter, there's a fly in my soup. Be quiet, sir, or else everybody's going to want one. But waiter, what's it doing in my soup? Looks like the backstroke to me, sir. Two very old vaudeville jokes about restaurants, because restaurants are everywhere, and we all have to eat, and restaurateuring can be a very tricky business, I'm sure. There is a variety in restaurants, but they're all basically the same. You know, you're going to get a starter and a main course and a dessert somewhere along the way. And some restaurants seem empty all the time. You walk past them day and night, nobody's in there, and you say to yourself, how do they make a living? And some are fleeting. Wasn't there a pizza place here last week, and now it's something else? And some are legendary. Oh, you have to eat there. It's been a corner function for 100 years, and the food is as good on this day as it was 100 years ago. And restaurants are carried by word of mouth, mostly. A good word from the mouth promotes them, and a bad word from the mouth kills them. Restaurants. And we all talk about restaurant experiences, don't we? Large numbers of my family are here this morning, and it wasn't long ago that we all went to celebrate family birthdays, which we do, and we picked an upscale restaurant uptown, and we went in, and we were about a table of 16, and the servers walked past us, and 15 minutes later walked past us again, served all the other tables, and then they walked past us again, and then they dropped one menu on the table, then they walked past us, and after 25 minutes, one of us said to them, what's happening? And the owner came over and said, well, you see, we're busy, we'll get to you when we can. And then when we finally got to order, most people wanted to order from this side of the menu, but a couple wanted to order from the other, and the owner said, oh, no, it has to be all one or all the other. So as a group, we got up and said, that's it, good night. And one of us turned and said, we have eaten as a family group in here 15 times. And we've told our friends, and we'll never eat here again, and we'll never recommend you to our friends, ever. And we went down the street to a meat place that was just hanging open onto the street, and we told them what happened. Well, they dusted off the seats, sat us all down, brought us meat, large, large chunks of meat. And we had the best evening, and the party was saved. The first restaurant was a loser, and the second one was a winner. It happens. And some restaurant experiences you never forget. A few years ago, Elspeth and I went to Nova Scotia for about 6 weeks to tour around, and we ended up in Pictou County. Pictou's a small place, and we went across a blacktop parking lot to a rickety-looking pub, and we went around the back up onto the outside veranda, and from there you could get a view of the Kleenex plant in the distance, and there were three bikers finishing their beer as we sat up there, and then they left, and the young waiter came out. He was a university student from Dalhousie or St. FX, and was a red-haired boy with freckles, maybe 18 years old, and he gave us the menus, and we looked for a few moments, and my wife said, well, I'll have a beer and a burger and fries. And he said, and what would you like? And I said, I think I'd like the crepe. He said, the what? The crepe. See it here in page 2, the crepe. Aha, the crepe, he said. And he left, and my wife said to me, are you nuts? This is a burger place, beer, burgers, fries, a crepe. And we sat for a while, and they brought the beer, and we sat for another little while, and after about 10 minutes, the young boy came out and said, it was the crepe, right? I said, yes, the crepe, okay. And then the burger came, and the fries came, and they were getting cold, and then about 10 minutes later, the owner came out. He said, did you order the crepe? I said, yes. He said, well, it fell on the floor. I said, all of it? Yes, all of it, he said. Do you have another? No. What would you like now instead? And my wife looked at me with an eagle eye. I said, I think I'd like the double-layered lasagna, long baked. She said, are you nuts? Well, we had something to eat. I can't remember what it was, and at the end, the owner came out and said, I'd like to apologize to you and giving you such a terrible experience, and we'd like you to give you your lunch for free. And we said, are you kidding? This was the best 2 hours we ever had in our life. And we paid full price for the meal, and we tipped the young red-haired boy $50 for his fall term at St. FX. it was an absolutely memorable time, and we laugh at it together ever since then. Well, churches are like restaurants, and you get different kinds. You get bistros, and you get big barns for family services, and you get theme venues, and you get casual and rough and ready places where you just sidle up to the bar and eat nuts and bar food, and then you get elegant places that have dress codes and codes of conduct in them, and you'd never cross the line. But all of them are about feeding people, aren't they? Bread and wine and heavenly banquet and fish and nurture and the cup of water given for thee are terms we use in the church every day. And each church has its own specialty. The good rule of thumb is order the specials. If it says the specials, don't order other things. The specials are what the chef does best and what the restaurant loves to serve. Churches self-select their congregations. If people come here wanting something they don't get, the church looks at them sideways, and the people soon leave to go to a place where they can get what they want. And churches depend on the whole dining experience, from the welcome at the door to the table conversation. Distance or nearness from the meal makes all the difference. Waiters that hover start to get in your way after a while, and waiters that never show up at all really start to bother you after a while. You see, I believe people come to church to do their knitting. We all come to do our knitting, and we bring our little bag of knitting with us, and we sit in the row, and we know why we've come, and we know the pattern we're trying to create, and we know whether we're stuck at a certain place or not, or whether we're doing fine, and we look along the row, and we catch sight of what someone else is knitting, and we may say, that's a very good idea, I've never thought that before, and we start working the piece into our own, and if someone's standing over you saying, I don't think that's the pattern we do around here, or those socks will never fit, after a while, you'll just stay home and do your knitting. That's how it works. And churches are wise to listen to customer feedback. If nobody likes baked beans, don't serve baked beans in your restaurant. There has to be a balance between what you feel is nourishing and the tastes and the hungers of the patrons. If there's a disconnect, no one's going to eat there and you're going to go out of business. And public worship is the menu at the restaurant. But there are other vital parts in a restaurant's life. Many of them we don't see, but they're there, and they make the place a success or a failure. The kitchen is a vital place. Is it fun? Is it functional? Are there enough cupboards? Can you store things and find them when you need them? The staff lounge area where they hang up their coats and take off their boots is important. A place to chat, a bright place, a place to wind down at the end of the day and to become friends with each other, not simply workers of tables. And you need to have clean storage areas. And then there are all the unspoken things behind the scenes at the restaurant. Is there real fellowship? Do the staff members get along with each other, or can you feel the tension when you come into the room? It makes a difference. People who are hungry are going to be put off their meal if the place feels bad or looks bad. Lightness of heart makes all the difference. We went to a restaurant one time along Davenport, and just a small one. We got in there for dinner, and the waiter came over to the table, and he said, I'd like to present a menu to you. We said, hello. I will be singing all the entrees. Well, I think we know what we want already. And he proceeded to sing the whole menu to us. And unfortunately, two people had a birthday there that night, so we got two choruses of happy birthday in a high tenor voice. And at the end, he said, would you like us to walk you to the parking lot? I said, no, that won't be necessary. But we never, ever forgot the restaurant. There's so much important about a restaurant's inner life. Public worship offers a variety of choices, and some parts of public worship are more appealing to some than to others, and that's natural. We offer a full menu here on a Sunday morning. Some people come here for the salad. People like the salad. It's interesting, and it's natural, and it's crisp. It's in meeting your friends and checking in as to how the week went on and smiling at the small things when the children are rehearsing their numbers for Sunday morning or whatever it may be. People like salad. And Mother always said salad was good for you, so you stuff salad in even if you don't like it at all. I'm not a big salad person. To me, it's always cold and tastes like grass. But my wife will say to me in the evenings, "Where's the green?" I said, "Well, St. Patrick's Day is coming in 7 months, so you can have it then." But I'm not a big salad person. But for some people at worship, it's the soup. They love the soup. They've had a hard day, and it's a hard season in their life, and there's a sadness to it, and winter's blowing on them, and they come into the restaurant, and they smell the aroma of soup that's been simmering all day, and then the tureen is brought to the table, and a great big scoop of soup is laid into the bowl, and there's a bit of crisp bread laid beside it, and the aroma fills, and you squeeze a bit of fresh pepper on the top of it, and there's your evening. "I don't need anything else but soup," they say. And the readings we get on a Sunday morning and the printed liturgies can be a lot like vegetables. Now, there are lots of people who love vegetables. I don't happen to be one of them, but there are. To me, vegetables are always undercooked, no matter how cooked they are. And they're always too plain, no matter how dressed up they are. That's just my taste. And I remember when I was a little boy, I choked on string beans, and I've never been able to look at the thing since. Even really thin people make me gag in the light of that. Now, some vegetables you get on a Sunday are all season. You see, you get the potatoes and the turnip, and they grow all year, and you count on them. The good, solid ones, the 23rd Psalm, and the great hymns of the church. The church's one foundation is Jesus Christ. Good old homegrown vegetables. And some are a bit more esoteric. They have an Indian or a Caribbean or an African beat to them. And you can take a little bit of them, but you wouldn't perhaps want a whole meal of them. But some restaurants shove a whole meal of them onto you. And 3 weeks after, as your stomach's burning in your side, you say, "Why did I ever go back to that place again and again?" But vegetables are good for you. You see, it's roughage, and you need roughage in your life, so your mother says. Some sermons, sermons, watch it. Some sermons can be fishy, don't you find? Just a little soft under the skin when you push down on them, and long time no see. They're fresh, and they come out of a can, and they've been sitting in water a long time, and you spread them on white bread, and you send it to lunch with your child, and you wonder why the bag comes back as full as it was when it went out the door. Well, some sermons are tough and stringy, too, aren't they? It was a poor cut of meat to start with, and it's been quickly cooked or undercooked, and then it's hidden in heavy spices and thick gravy. Don't you hate it when liturgy bubbles over into thick sauces and spicy gravy? And now, friends, we're going to sing one of our very, very favorite hymns. Oh, it was my mother's favorite hymn, yes. Good old 261. That's 261. I know it's on the board, but 261. Turn to it now, won't you? And we're going to start. For God's sakes, just sing the hymn, will you? I don't need all the spicy sauce. I don't need to hear how much your mother loved it. Just give the hymn. The liturgy belongs to the people, and on it goes. Too many spices, too much thick sauce. But what about the dessert? Do we have enough dessert in public worship, do you think? Does anyone come rushing in the door, sit down among the folk, and shout, "Keep your fork, there's pie"? Does anybody ever do that? Or are people sort of hanging on, hoping it isn't too bad before it's over? Life's short, eat dessert first. Does anybody say that when they come to worship? I see dessert in today's texts that were read. In Isaiah chapter 62, the restoration of Zion, I see steaming, flaming Christmas pudding. Did you see that? Well, I grew up in a bakery, you see, so I see desserts a lot of places in my mind. It was a cold, ordinary time for the exiles in Israel before that, but it suddenly became a festive time now because somebody brought flaming Christmas pudding into the mix of it. We were at Patricia and William Wright's the other night, just after Christmas, for an opportunity to spend some time together, and it was a wonderful meal, as they are wont to give, and William Wright brought out flaming Christmas pudding at the end. And he told in detail about the recipe. It's an old recipe made mostly of carrots. It makes it sweet and juicy. And then you steam it. And then you put lots of butter in it so it bubbles all up all over the place. And then you bring wine for it. But it's not any wine. It's very expensive wine that comes from Germany. And we brought it over, carried it past customs with a straight face. And we poured the wine all over the thing. And then we lit it up. And this thing burst into flame. And it was quite wonderful. And we ate it. And then we put the hard sauce on it with the liquor in it and the little maraschino cherries in green and red on the top and scooped it off. And after we'd eaten our fill, he said, "Would you like another slice of that? Isn't it good?" And of course we would, but we didn't. But it felt wonderful. Suddenly it was Christmas all over again, and the dessert was spectacular. Well, that's what the children of Israel felt when they brought out the flaming Christmas pudding in that story. "You shall be a crown of beauty in the hands of the Lord," says the text. "No more called forsaken, now called my delight." Big difference. And the 1 Corinthians text spoke to me of the shared joy around making Tipsy Laird. And here comes the sermon title, Tipsy Laird, the Scottish classic dessert. It's a trifle, really, but it's not an English trifle with sherry dribbled over the top. It's a Scottish trifle with whiskey poured over the middle. A big, big difference. Well, it's easy to make, and you can't go wrong. And I see a group of people gathering together, like the folk in the 1 Corinthians reading, each bringing their gifts to it. Somebody brings the glass bowl, and then somebody gets the lady finger white cake and presses it down all around the bottom. And then someone pours in a custard, which he or she has made, and fills the thing up about three-quarters of the way. And then someone brings out the Scots whiskey from one of the Highland distilleries and pours out 6 tablespoons over the cake. And someone else says, "What are you, chintzy?" and pours another 6 tablespoons over the cake, and then there's whipped cream on top of that, and then there are Scottish raspberries dribbled on top of that, and then there might be a little shaving of white or dark chocolate on top of that. And the rule of thumb is eat it now and don't keep it, because it won't last very long, and it doesn't last very long in the bowl either. And when I read the miracle of the water into wine this time, it shouted Tipsy Laird to me. There are empty bowls sitting there waiting on the sideboard, all sad. And then the whiskey, Jesus Christ, the Highland cream, is poured out among them. And the custard of sweet surprise fills the bowl. And whipped cream creates a miracle of delight. And the text at the bottom is, most people serve the good stuff first to look good. Then when no one can taste the difference, they bring out the bad stuff. But you have saved the best till last. Tipsy Laird, I heard it and I saw it. Tipsy Laird completes a meal and everybody's happy with it because everyone's been involved in the making of it and in the eating of it. A sense of warm grace fills the room. The servants who stirred the pot know exactly how it was made, and they are touched by the miracle of how it all comes together and tastes more wondrous than they realized. Worship and congregational life needs dessert. Dessert. This church is a splendid restaurant. Well, you know that. The setting and the decor and the quality of the kitchen and the warmth of the servers and the brightness and the hunger of the patrons. In bitter and sad and social times, in times ahead, in thin times and in rich times, keep your eye on the dessert, won't you? You can get pretty excited about it when it comes to dessert. A few years ago, Elspeth was given an afternoon at Scaramouche Restaurant up on Avenue Road. It was a cooking class in which the grand chef there and the sous chefs were going to spend 2 hours teaching you how to make things. And she said, "I can't go today. Why don't you go?" So the room was full, about 200 women, and I was the only man. And I was sitting up in the back row, and we were all jammed into benches along the very back row. You couldn't move to the left or the right. And for an hour and a half, the chef would cook and talk, and the sous chefs would clean the stand, and then they would go again. And the whole time, the air conditioner above me dripped right on my crotch. Drip, drip, drip. I couldn't move to the left or the right. because there were people there I didn't know. I couldn't keep putting my hands over myself. That didn't go over big either. And at the end of the hour and a half, there was a huge wet spot in the middle of my crotch and halfway down my legs. And the woman next to me getting up took a look and said, "You really enjoyed the event, didn't you?" I said, "You know, madam, it tasted a lot like Tipsy Laird." Thank you.